Turn to the book of 1 Peter, chapter 5. 1 Peter, chapter 5. We'll read the first 9 verses. 1 Peter 5, verses 1 through 9. The elders, which are among you, speaking of an office, pastor, I exhort, who am also an elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, and also a partaker of the glory that shall be revealed. Feed the flock of God which is among you, taking the oversight thereof, not by constraint, but willingly, not for filthy lucre, but of a ready mind. Neither has been lords over God's heritage, but being examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd shall appear, ye, talking to these elders, shall receive a crown of glory that fadeth not away. Likewise, ye younger, hung about the rest of the flock, submit yourselves unto the elder, yea, all of you. And I believe this is talking about the elder and the rest of the flock. Be subject one to another. Be clothed with humility. For God resisteth the proud and giveth grace to the humble. Humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time. Casting all your care upon him, for he careth for you. Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary the devil, as a roaring lion, walketh about, seeking whom he may devour, whom the devil resist, steadfast in faith, knowing that the same afflictions are accomplished in your brethren that are in the world. In order to appreciate these words and their significance, we need to understand what was going on when these were written, or shortly after they were written. The book of 1 Peter was written to a people living in the midst of a rising hostility and persecution. As for Christianity at this time, the stage was being set for very severe persecution and even martyrdom. History tells us that in 64 AD, which is about the time 1 Peter would have been written, that a fire broke out in the city of Rome. Hundreds and hundreds of public buildings were burned, such as temples and shrines, many acres, thousands of homes were destroyed, many, of course, were homeless. History has concluded that Rome's emperor, Nero, set the fire. The reason he did so was to destroy old buildings, so that he would have a reason to build new and better buildings, marble palaces and monuments, that would establish his name in history. So he did this for his legacy. There's a message there. We're not going to go there. The Romans believed all along that Nero had set the fire. And as time went on, they were becoming more and more incensed. And they were ready to revolt and overthrow him. So Nero, to put an end to the uprising against them, decided that he would redirect their hostility. And he blamed the fire on a group of people called Christians. Now, These were already hated by the Romans. And Nero, having redirected their hostility, then launched an all-out persecution against the Lord's churches. And we see that during this time, many of God's people were imprisoned, many were killed, died horrible deaths. But during this time, God's people were severely tested. They were ridiculed and mocked. Many had to flee their homes, separated from their families and their living. It was a time that if you were identified as a Christian, persecution was inevitable. And the threat of death was in the air. Throughout the letter, Peter makes mention of their sufferings and their difficulties. And as you read the letter, it seems that these were a people, many of them, who were struggling to live their faith. And many, no doubt, were discouraged and distressed. And some were beginning to think, it's all pointless. There's no use. Peter wrote this letter to instruct these of what their proper response to their suffering ought to be. He wrote to point them to Christ as their example in all things. He wrote to encourage them to press on in the cause of Christ. This was the purpose of writing this letter. Now, we today, unlike those to whom Peter was writing, we haven't been arrested. We haven't been driven from our homes. We haven't lost all of our material possessions for living the Christian life. And unlike them, we have not faced martyrdom. But the stage is being set. Make no mistake about it. So what Peter, and the reason I said that is because what Peter writes to these individuals, you and I would be very wise to take heed. In our text, he begins verses 1 through 4 by addressing the elders or the pastors. If I was at a conference, I would elaborate more, but there's no point here. And then he proceeds to address both the pastors and the flock. In verse 8, he identifies, or he says that they have an adversary, and he identifies him as the devil. He then speaks of this adversary's characteristics, saying that he is as a roaring lion, which speaks of the fact that he is bloodthirsty, he is threatening, he is full of fury, he's fierce, he's very resolute. He speaks of his hostile opposition, his activity, and his intent. He says he walketh about in such a way that all, in some way, are exposed to his influence. And he walks about doing this, seeking whom he may devour or destroy and ruin. And then in verse 9, we see our call. Whom resist? That is, we are to withstand this adversary. We are to oppose this adversary. And then we see we're to do this remaining steadfast in the faith, whom resist steadfast in the faith. And as we do this, we are to know something. Knowing that the same afflictions are accomplished in your brethren that are in the world. In other words, you're not in this alone. Don't forget, don't fall into the trap that you're the only one fighting this battle, having this struggle. So Peter is telling his readers who were struggling in this warfare, he is saying Satan must be resisted. He has to be resisted. It is not enough for you and I to just determine, starting today, I am going to resist Satan. Well, how are you going to do that? You see, there are other matters that must take place. There are other matters that are absolutely essential if you and I are going to resist Satan. And we cannot afford not to resist, to successfully resist Satan. For he seeks to have each and every one of us. He seeks to draw each one of us into sin. He seeks to get some sort of advantage or leverage in our lives. He seeks to turn us aside. He seeks to weaken our resolve. He seeks to imprison us. And I'm not talking about physical prisons. He seeks to imprison us. In our text, there are instructions for you and I. And in these instructions, we see a path that is formed to successfully resist Satan. So that's what we want to speak upon this morning, the path to successfully resisting Satan. Satan must not only be resisted, he must be successfully resisted. It's not enough in the end to say, oh, well, I tried. That's not good enough. So we see here a path to successfully resisting Satan. Again, verse 9, whom resist steadfast in the faith. But he said several things leading up to that statement. And that's what we want to observe. Number one, there has to be a proper attitude toward one another. Talking about bodies of Christ. Notice verse 5. Be subject. The word be is present tense singular. So it's something each and every one of us must do, and we must continually do. Be subject one to another. This sentiment is also declared in Ephesians 5:21, submitting, that's present tense, continual action, submitting yourselves one to another in the fear of God. So in both places, we see this phrase, one to another, indicating that there is a connection, that there is a relationship, but not only a connection and a relationship to one another, there is a responsibility to one another. The idea is that we are to recognize ourselves, I'm speaking of a church body, as members one of another. The word subject one to another speak of a mindset toward one another, conveying the idea of that we are to relinquish self for one another, that we are to yield self for one another. What is being taught here is opposed to self-assertion. It is opposed to self-centeredness. It is opposed to individualism. It is opposed to self-seeking. What is taught here is opposed to striving for the mastery of personal advantage over someone else. What is taught here is opposed to anger. It is opposed to resentment toward one another. It is opposed to animosity toward one another. And it is opposed to looking for reasons to be angry, to be resentful, to be disgruntled, or to be hurt. What is said here goes back to Romans 15 and verse 1, that we are not to please ourselves. If you keep a mark here, it also refers back to Philippians. Notice Philippians chapter 1. Verse 27, the last part of that verse says, with one mind striving together for the faith of the gospel. That's what he's saying here in our text. Notice chapter 2, verses 2 through 4. Fulfill ye my joy and be like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord, of one mind. Let nothing be done through strife or vainglory, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem other better than themselves. Look not every man on his own things. That is, do not just be consumed with your own things, but every man also on the things of others. So what Peter is saying here in our text in verse 5, this one to another, is we must come to the realization that God has brought us together, and we are in this thing together by the design of God. Whether you like it or not, that is the fact. God has brought us together. God has put us together. He has put us together in this time, and we are in this together against this adversary. Now, one of Satan's chief strategies amongst the Lord's churches, amongst believers as a whole, is to divide and conquer. And you can be sure of this. Satan has not been successfully resisted where there are wrong attitudes one to another. And he will not be successfully resisted where there are wrong attitudes one toward another. Secondly, verse 5, we are to be clothed in humility. Notice again verse 5. Be, again, present tense singular. That is, we as individuals, this is something we are to continually do. Be clothed with humility. In verse 6, he says, humble yourselves. Humble yourselves. Now, humility is not a one-time act. Humility is a habit. It is a characteristic. It is a habit of heart and mind that recognizes our vileness and our unworthiness before God. It is the inward sense that in the big picture, in viewing God, that we are insignificant. It is a spirit of submission. It is a spirit of absolute dependence upon God. And it is an attitude of contentment to have it that way. That's humility. Humility in heart and mind. It is the antithesis of pride, which of course is the preoccupation with self, the service of self, the feeling of self-importance, the feeling of self-admiration, self-exaltation. It is self-will. It is a feeling of self-righteousness, self-gratification. So humility is a self-abasement before God. It is a low estimation of ourselves, not only before God, but as we just read in Philippians 2, in relation to one another. It's not some facade that you put on to impress others. Jesus made that clear in Matthew 6, verse 16. But it's an inward reality. May we say that humility is not a weakness. It's not a flaw. It's not something to be avoided. It's not something to be shied away from. It is a Christ-like virtue, something we ought to seek personally. Now notice the degree of humility. It says that we are to be clothed with it. That means covered with it, blanketed in humility, enveloped with humility. How humble should we be? We're to be covered with it, blanketed in it. Now, the road to humility, you don't just wake up one day and decide to be humble. The road to humility, first of all, pride has to be overcome. That has to be overcome. How do we overcome pride? Well, we begin to realize who God is. And we view ourselves before God. It is realizing what salvation is. How we were saved. Why we were saved. It is realization of the blessings of God in our life. It is a realization of to whom the glory belongs. This is how pride is overcome. One of Satan's chief strategy is pride in God's people. So we can be sure of this. Where there is pride, Satan has not been successfully resisted. And where there is pride, he is not going to be successfully resisted. And in order to obtain, in order to maintain a proper attitude toward one another, this humility is absolutely necessary. It is essential. And in order to successfully resist Satan, humility is absolutely necessary. That brings us to the third thing. That's also in verse 5, and it is a right relationship with God. In verse 5, again, be clothed with humility. As an incentive to that, we read, God resisteth the proud. That is, pride, the opposite of humility, puts one in opposition to God. It puts you in a wrong relationship with God. But also notice, and giveth grace to the humble. Which means that humility puts you in favor with God, or in a right relationship with God. Verse 6, humble yourselves therefore. Again, in light of the fact that if you are proud, you are in opposition to God. If you are humble, you are in a right relationship with God. Because of this, humble yourselves therefore. And then notice the next word, under. Under. Subordinate. Inferior to. Controlled by. Under the mighty hand of God. That needs to be our position. That needs to be our relationship. Under the mighty hand of God. If we do not have a right relationship with God, if that be so in your life right now, you are not in a right relationship with God, I assure you, Satan has not been successfully resisted in your life. And I assure you of this, as long as you remain in a wrong relationship with God, Satan will not be successfully resisted in your life. So there has to be this relationship with God. Brings us to number 4, the proper handling of cares. And we want to spend most of our time on this. Verse 7, casting all your care upon Him. Now what came before that? Right relationship to one another. Humility. A right relationship with God. Now that you have that, you can do verse 7. Casting all your care upon Him. Now this verse tells us that if we have a right relationship with one another, if we have a right relationship with God, and if we are humble, that does not exempt us from care. Casting all your care upon Him. There are 3 points that we want to notice in this verse. First of all, there is the existence or the admission of personal cares. The word care has reference to concerns. Most people, when they think of it, they think of trials, they think of tribulations, or they may think of sin. Those are included, but it speaks of any concern that you and I might have. It speaks of anything that causes us anxiety, anything that might cause us stress, pressure. These are all real life issues. Now, the Bible presents that there are various categories of these cares. And in noticing these categories, we see that they're not necessarily sinful. In fact, most of our cares are not sinful. Matthew chapter 6, verse 25, we see category of cares. Therefore I say unto you, take no thought for your life. And notice what it says. What does life involve? Well, it involves what we shall eat, what we shall drink. It involves our body, what we shall put on. Those are all cares. Those are all concerns. They are all by God's appointment. They're all necessities of life. So one category of cares are simply the necessities of life. You get married. you now have a care. Marriage and family bring cares into our lives. We read in 1 Corinthians 7, verse 29, they that have wives. And then he gives instruction in verse 32 and 33. Marriage and family involves husbands, wives, children, grandchildren, aging parents. Those are all cares. Those are all concerns. There isn't anyone here that is married and has a family that does not have these concerns. You have concerns. If you don't, then something's very wrong. You have concerns for your husband. You have concerns for your wife. You have concerns for your children. Are these sinful? No, they're not sinful. You have burdens concerning these things. You may have grandchildren. You may have aging parents. You may have unhealthy family members. You may have dying family members. These are all concerns. It is a category of concern. Not sinful. There are categories of friendships. Every friendship you make brings another care into your life. Friendships involves cares, it involves concerns, it involves burdens. Every relationship you enter into brings another burden into your life. These are not sinful. These are simply the issues of life. Then, of course, there are the cares, the category of circumstances. Paul addresses this in 1 Corinthians 7, verse 30. Sorrow and joy. Circumstances bring care. Something happens today that causes you great concern or that causes you a great burden. There are the cares of circumstances. There is the category of business. If you have a job or you own a business, you have responsibilities, you have cares, you have concerns, you have burdens. These are not sinful things. These are just categories of cares. There is the category of worldly interest. Now, some of these can become sinful. But not all worldly interests are sinful. God has given us the world to enjoy. 1 Corinthians 7, verse 31. There's also the category of the world's traps. Some of these we bring into our lives, these become sinful cares. The truth is, it is not hard to find something to worry about. That's not hard. It is not hard to find something to stress about. It is not hard to find something to complain about. It's not hard. It's very easy. And it is not hard to find something that is a problem in our life or in the life of someone else. But then there is another category exclusive to you and I that are saved. Cares that come with service to the Lord. 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 28. Beside those things which are without, that which cometh upon me daily, the care of all the churches. A member of a New Testament Baptist church has additional burdens, has an additional level of responsibilities. So we all have cares. And we all have to do something with them. And we all handle these cares. We all deal with them in some way. But there is a danger. If we do not handle them correctly, that we become weighted down with them. That becomes a problem. that we become strapped and preoccupied and distracted, resulting in the fact that we become spiritually unhealthy. And we begin to possess a feeling of constant gnawing and a sense of being pulled in several directions. That's what happens if we do not properly handle our cares. Now notice there, secondly, there is an action in regard to these cares. Casting all your care upon Him. Look at those three words. Casting your care. That is a personal and conscious decision. Casting your care. It is also a personal, persistent action. Notice that this concerns all your care. It is not merely come to Him with all your cares. That's not what it says. It says casting. Now, granted, you have to come to Him in order to do this. But you can come to Him without casting. So it's not merely coming to Him with our cares. It is casting all your care upon Him. The word casting means to throw upon. It's indicative of letting go. Casting all your care upon Him. It is our human care is being transferred to God. We're not talking about ignoring responsibilities. We're not talking about quitting life. We're talking about properly handling our responsibilities, properly handling our cares, casting all your care upon Him. So the question is, how do we do this? I mean, it's easy to say to anybody, cast all your care upon Him. Well, how do I do that? How do I cast my care upon Him? I believe the answer is in Philippians 4, verse 6. Be careful. That is, be anxious, worried, and stressed for nothing. Nothing is a universal word. But rather than being anxious and worried, in everything, that's another universal word, he then proceeds to tell them what to do, and he is telling us how we cast our care upon Him. He mentions four actions here in Philippians 4 and verse 6. He says, by prayer. By is a preposition indicating the means of achieving something. How are we not to be anxious for nothing? By prayer. Now, I believe that is a general term. And I believe he is saying, get to the posture in your soul of becoming prayerful. How do we do that? By following the directions we've already seen leading up to casting all your care upon Him. Get yourself in a condition where you can pray. Because until you're in that condition, you can't cast your care upon Him. Then notice what else he says. By prayer and supplication. Supplication means to beg. It means to plead. It is holding our hands out to God. Holding our hands out to God. It is taking the position of a beggar before God. Now, before you can do that, you have to be in a prayerful state. You have to be in a humbled state. You have to be in a right relationship with God. Take a position as a beggar before God. And then he says, with thanksgiving. That word with is another preposition, meaning that our supplication is to be accompanied by thanksgiving. Speaking of giving thanks to God, an attitude of gratefulness. Then notice what it says. Let your requests. I believe many times we make our requests known before we get into a position of prayer, before we take the position of a beggar, and before we have an attitude of gratitude, we just immediately pour out our requests to God. There's a definite order here. And let your requests be made known unto God. What does that mean? It means tell the Lord. Now you're in a position to tell the Lord. Put all that together, and that's how you cast all your care upon Him. That's how it's done. Notice back in 1 Peter 5, verse 7, the third thing in this verse, there's an encouragement for you and I to do so. For He careth for you. My cares are God's cares. Whatever it is that is a concern to you and I, whatever it is that is a burden to us, whatever it is that troubles us, whatever it is that stresses us and weighs us down and overcomes us, and fills us with discouragement and anxiety, be sure of this, God is not troubled. God is not stressed. God is not weighted down. He's not overcome. He's not discouraged. He's not anxious. For He careth for you. What that means is that God has chosen to be interested in me. I mean, that alone should humble us. God has chosen to be interested in me. Every one of us, presently, right now at this moment, have cares. If I were to give each one a piece of paper and tell you to write down the three most pressing cares, we could all do that without much thought. There isn't one of us that would sit here and think, wow, I got to really think about that. No, we could write them down pretty quick. In fact, most of us would say, just three? Is that all you want? Is just three? There's a lot more than three. With these cares upon our minds, here's what we're to do. We're to have a proper attitude toward one another. We're to be clothed with humility. We're to be in a right relationship with God. We are to be in a prayerful state. We are to take the position of a beggar. We are to have an attitude of gratefulness. And now we're to tell the Lord. Now we're to tell Him. And what is the result? Notice back again in Philippians chapter 4. Philippians chapter 4, we see the peace of God, and the peace of God which passeth all understanding. That is, after you do verse 6, the peace of God that passeth understanding shall keep your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus. How do I know that I've cast my cares upon Him? The peace of God overcomes me. That's how you know. And again, all of this brings us to our next point and last point, and we'll hurry. There is a release. Once we've cast our cares upon Him, this peace of God has overcome us. There is a release from distraction. Notice verse 8. Be sober. That means be clear-headed. It's the opposite of being drunk. Be clear-headed, be rational, do not be under the influence of outside forces, cares. Be vigilant. That is, be attentive, be alert, be on guard, be mindful. Now, I just noticed this yesterday. Notice, he does not say, be sober and vigilant. That's not what he says. He says, be sober, be vigilant. There's a repetition. And I believe that's there for emphasis. Be sober. How are we sober? How is it that our minds are not distracted and under the influence of other things? You've cast all your care upon Him. And now you can be sober. There are a lot of Christian drunks today. And I'm not talking about drinking. They're not sober-minded because they don't cast their care upon the Lord. They can't think about the things of the Lord. Their minds are too distracted. Again, there's a definite order here. There's matters leading up to casting all your care upon Him. And after you've cast all your care upon Him, now you can be sober. You can be clear-headed. And you can be vigilant. That is, now you can be on guard. There's not anything else to distract you. And here's why we need to be sober and be vigilant. Because your adversary, the devil, walking about as a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. It's important that you and I be focused, that you and I be serious about the right matters. And we can't do that until we've accomplished these other things. That's the problem today in Christianity. That is the problem today in our world. We want to jump to the last step and avoid everything else. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. It doesn't work in life. It doesn't work in Christianity. It doesn't work in spiritual matters. There are steps to follow. And we see this here, a path to successfully resisting Satan. Satan desires to have each and every one of us. And we must successfully resist him. Satan desires to tear your family into shreds. He desires to tear his church into shreds. Satan must be successfully resisted. But that's more than just a group of people or an individual standing up and declaring, I am going to resist Satan. You have to follow these steps. And the end result is, Satan is successfully resisted. Lastly, these steps also present to us, they reveal to us what the devil uses to devour. We're told that he seeketh whom he may devour. What does he use to devour? Well, it's the very steps. We're to have a right attitude one toward another. Satan uses division amongst the brethren. Because if he can get us to fight amongst ourselves, our attention has now been diverted off of him. Oh, and I know God's people have been doing it for thousands of years. They are fighting amongst themselves in an effort to resist the devil. The devil has you fooled. You only think you're resisting the devil. The truth is, you're giving him ammunition. He will use pride. He will use pride. Someone stands up and says, well, I'm just a prideful person. That's nothing to brag about, my friend. That's a serious problem. The devil will use pride. He will use a wrong relationship with the Lord. He will use legitimate cares in our lives. Family, jobs, legitimate cares. Things that we are responsible to do. He will use those things. Causing us to hold unto them and not releasing them unto the Lord. Oh, how we need to realize the seriousness of what is before us. We have an adversary, and he must be successfully resisted in our individual lives and in our collective lives. And God has given us the path to do so. Brother Larry, if you'd come and lead us in verse 1.